This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. In the beginning, there was the Instapundit, one of the first great aggregator and commentary sites on the World Wide Web in the early 21st century. Launched in August 2001, the site became massively popular after the 9/11 attacks when it acted as a clearinghouse for information and commentary from all over the world about what the hell was going on. It was dreamed up by Glenn Reynolds, a law professor at the University of Tennessee, who came to be known as the blog father to many of us then toiling on the border between print and pixels. Reynolds has always been a tech-forward writer and scholar. He's called himself a libertarian transhumanist at times, and he authored the 2006 bestseller, An Army of Davids, How Markets and Technology Empower Ordinary People to Beat Big Media, Big Government, and Other Goliaths. He's written many hundreds of thousands of words and several more books since then, including his brand new book, which you can get from Encounter Books or at Amazon. It's called The Social Media Upheaval, and it argues that Google, Facebook, Twitter, and other platforms are an absolute threat to journalism, democracy, our psychological health, and ultimately even our very civilization or society. We're going to talk about that today and the long, strange online trip the one and only Instapundit has made from the early days of his web adventures to his current belief that big tech should be broken up via antitrust actions. Glenn Reynolds, thanks as always for talking to Reason.
Thanks for having me here. It's always fun.
Give me the elevator pitch of the social media upheaval.
So what I tried to figure out is basically why people and society seem crazier today. In fact, as it's the sort of breakout quote from the book on the back cover is, society seems to be growing steadily crazier. And maybe it doesn't just seem to be. Maybe it actually is growing crazier. And that was sort of my starting point. I wrote a column a while back for USA Today, where I write regularly. And it was basically saying, you know, Robert Heinlein's future history had the early 21st century as a period he called the crazy years. And his theory was that social mores would break down and technology would move so fast that the society would essentially kind of go insane, not everyone in it necessarily, but as a whole. So I looked around, I was like, maybe that is happening. And if it is, why? And one of the things that struck me, I was reading a book by James Scott, who I'm a huge fan of. Some of listeners may remember his book, Seeing Like a State or Two Cheers for Anarchy. But the book I was reading was called Against the Grain. And it's a book he wrote about the very earliest cities and civilizations. And one of their biggest characteristics was that, you know, people would build a city and several hundred or even several thousand people would crowd in there and everything would be swell for a while. And then, poof, it would just depopulate. And it turned out the reason for this was that you got all these people who had always lived as hunters and gatherers scattered across in small numbers. And you crammed them all together cheek by jowl with no real idea of sanitation. And it's just a petri dish for spreading disease in a way that humanity had, for the million or ever, however many years prior to that, that was never encountered. So pretty soon some horrible disease would spread like wildfire through this population that had never been so close together. And I was, as I was reading that, I was also just happened to see a quote from Richard Fernandez saying, what kind of mental viruses are we unleashing via social media? And it occurred to me that the sort of hothouse environments of social media on corporate platforms where interaction is super fast and effortless are kind of like those early cities. People who follow Reason are probably familiar with the idea of memes, not as cat pictures with captions, but as self-reproducing ideas that spread from mind to mind, kind of like a virus. And I think one of the characteristics that you find, especially on Twitter, which is the sort of most distilled and crude version of social media, is that it's like everybody sharing one toothbrush, that somebody puts out an idea and people can just share it to all their followers almost instantly. You can share it to almost all of theirs. And they usually, if there's a link, most people, as research shows, don't actually follow the link or read what it's about. They respond sort of emotionally and by impressions. And even worse than that, the whole business model of social media companies is what I refer to as algorithmic jiggery pokery. And that means you don't just see stuff in the order it appears. You see stuff that they want you to see, and that's driven primarily on engagement. Engagement really means emotional response. And as Jaron Lanier points out, the easy emotional responses to provoke are mostly the negative ones. And so what social media in general, and again, Twitter is the worst of these, they're designed to amplify bad emotions. And it's not surprising that when you're on them, you get angrier and sadder.
You know, I've got like more emergency kitten-like accounts on my Twitter feed than I know what to do with, Clem. Because it's not all anger and aggravation.
You're right.
But
you're right. And there's always ultra-rad chicks, but you know, but I don't
you,
think they're
you gave up. You mentioned in the book that you quit Twitter in 2018. I guess last year. What was there a particular event where you're like, "Fuck it, I'm done"?
Yeah. I was really planning to do it for a while. I hadn't gotten around to it, and partly driven by the research for this book. The more I read, the more I was like, "Oh, maybe this is why Twitter seems to make me angry." They banned somebody. I think it was they were doing, as they still are, a bunch of pointless bans. Yeah. I think it may have been Jesse Kelly. There's not even somebody I was especially close to or cared about that much. But I just saw that, and that just somehow crystallized. I was like, "Ah, fuck it!" And I just really went and deleted my account. And it's now past recovery. People keep trying to get me to go back to Twitter. And I'm like, my followers are all gone. It's not going to happen. And I'm happy.
Well, first, before I get to a more pointed question, you write at one point that social media, and in particular Twitter, it both makes us less well-informed but more partisan. In the research that you were looking at, what explains that? Because one would assume, you know, given that we're living in a nice world of, you know, kind of autonomous, mostly rational human beings, the less you know about something, the less likely you are to think that you should really form a strong emotional or tribal attachment to one side or the other in an argument. But obviously, that does not seem to be happening.
There was actually an NBC poll out today that I just heard discussed on the radio. I read the poll, but it basically said that of Democratic primary voters, the ones with the strongest opinions were the ones who knew the least about politics. And so I think that's actually not uncommon. I think that, you know, well, all social media have a lot of these things in context. I pick on Twitter because Twitter reminds me one of those. If you're out in the desert in Nevada, if you go to these gas stations where there's like a half dozen slot machines and some really sad old people mechanically pulling the lever over and over again. And that's when you see the real core of what gambling is. If you go to a casino and they're going around with trays of free drinks and women in short dresses and they've got, you know, fancy lighting and carpets and Celine Dion or something, you can miss the core. So on Instagram, you see all these pictures, or Facebook, you see people's kids and all. For Twitter, it's really stripped down. But I think they all have this to some degree. I wish that it was part of the human character that we formed our opinions with a strength that was proportionate to our knowledge. But it absolutely doesn't work that way, and it doesn't take very long to see that.
Do you think, there have been a number of studies that have shown that, you know, the vast, you know, which goes to your point about gambling or drinking or all sorts of activities where it's a relatively small group of people who generate most of the activity or most of the revenue for a casino. It's something like 10% of people who drink, buy 90% of liquor. Twitter, a handful of people actually generate a huge amount of the information or the tweets and stuff like that. Do you think it has been going downhill? I mean, it's not that many years ago. And I disagree with you broadly about the variety and interest level and usefulness, I think, of social media. But I get where you're coming from. But, you know, it wasn't that long ago that Twitter was being hailed as the medium that facilitated the Arab Spring. Or that help people kind of heal from the Bataclan shooting and things like that. Has Twitter been going downhill kind of along the lines that you were talking about, the early cities that were good for a while and then just something flips?
I do think Twitter has gone downhill, and I think there are a number of characteristics or reasons for that. I mean, one of them is I think Twitter management has really done a pretty bad job of running it. Secondarily, they've amped up over the time since like 2009, 2010, the engagement algorithms, which I think have made it a very different user experience in a lot of ways. And then also it's a well-known characteristic of internet for going back to, you know, I started in the 80s on FidoNet and CompuServe, that when they first start out, they tend to be sort of bright and shiny and everybody's friendly and cheerful and nice. And they degenerate after a while into flame wars. I've seen People have written some fairly famous timelines of how every internet forum works in that regard, and unfortunately, they're dead on, and that may be inevitable. Also, you know,
so you're like a soldier who's been in so many different online campaigns, right? You were called up in World War I, World War II, Korea. Right,
the war, the war will not be over for Christmas, kids. No matter what they tell you. I think it's really hard to sort of sort out cost effect. Our politics has gotten meaner, and some of that I think is driven by social media, but I'm sure it's a mutually reinforcing kind of thing. Right. And I will say my own feeling, I wrote a review in the Wall Street Journal of Jaron Lanier's book, You Are Not a Product, which was his first of several diatribes against social media. Mm-hmm. And I guess that was probably like 2011. And I was pretty critical of him. And I said, you know, these social media platforms, sure, they're there's privacy worries and everything, but they bring people a lot of happiness. And, you know, personally, I like seeing what old girlfriends are doing on Twitter, or, you know, what my law students are doing on Twitter who graduated 10 years ago or whatever. And that, on Facebook. And that brings a lot of pleasure to people's lives, a lot of interconnection. And you have to weigh those things together. And that's still true. But what I will say is I think the balance has shifted. And I think the harm is greater now than it was then. And I think the good is less now than it was then. So I think the net is also different than it was. And again, I think some of that is because of things, and Jaron Lanier has a new book out called 10 Reasons You Should Quit Your Social Media Right Now, where he really goes into how the engagement algorithms affect things. And I think they've cranked those up, and that has made it worse.
So, you know, one thing about Lanier, and this goes to a more pointed question for you, it's like, well, you know, Lanier was there at the beginning. You know, they kind of opened up the hatch where the internet was, and he was already living there in early virtual reality, you know, I mean, kind of the widely regarded as the, you know, the kind of creator of virtual reality in an operational sense, et cetera. He's an old hippie who's pissed that the web, or, you know, that the internet turned into the web, that it was commercialized, et cetera. And I get the sense from reading him that he's just mad it didn't turn out the way he wanted it to. Is there, I mean, in yourself, do you find a kind of old fogyism? You've talked about, you know, being on CompuServe. You know, your book, you know, talks a lot about like Usenet groups and flame wars and stuff like that. And, you know, is it just that like, you know, the kids these days, you don't like, even if they're the same age as you online.
Yeah, well, they are the same age as me. I mean, that's the joke. In fact, my experience with, you know, my daughter's friends and with my law students and such is a lot fewer younger people are on social media. And when they are, they tend to do it less. And they are interestingly, generally kind of afraid of social media in a way I think nobody was 5 or 10 years ago. And I think that's because they've learned from experience. And maybe I've learn from experience too. You know, what I will say, and I draw a distinction in the book between the old days of the blogosphere and social media, and they're very different kinds of systems. The blogosphere was what engineers call a loosely coupled system. You put something on your blog and nothing changed as a consequence, unless somebody else chose to put up a post in response or to put up a link to it or something. And it was relatively slow. There was no, you know, there's no equivalent of a retweet or share button. Somebody had to actually think about it and write something. And even something that spread rapidly through the blogosphere probably took a day or two. And people who were blogging had something of an investment in credibility and stuff because they wanted people to keep coming back to their sites. There's no common channel that you can just sort of troll on. Usenet had a common channel, and Usenet was known very early on for trolling and flame wars. Social media have a common channel, and they're tightly coupled. When you tweet something and people retweet it, it can spread super fast. And, you know, one of the things engineers tell you about tightly coupled systems is they're prone to cascading failures. And that, I think, is something we see every time we get these outrage mobs or a wave of fake news or whatever that spreads like wildfire. And I think also, because with a common channel like social media have, it's possible to censor people, which it really wasn't with the old blogosphere. Mm-hmm. That inevitably produces demands to censor people. And then people running social media are put in a position of deciding, well, who do I censor and who don't? And those tend to be driven not so much by what's right or what's wrong or even what's good for our business model as much as what will positively or negatively impact my standing with my peer group. And that seems to be what drives most of the decision making now. And
so you totally buy the argument, and I think there's a fair amount of evidence to it, that the heads of the big kind of social media platforms, and we'll use that term a little bit loosely to include something like YouTube and also Patreon, even Roku, much less Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, that, you know, what's driving Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Twitter, is not what's going to be good for Twitter's business model, which, as you were saying, I mean, it's, you know, one of the things that we need to always think about when we're talking about Twitter is it's an incredibly poorly run company that can't get its shit together to really kind of get to the next level of commercial feasibility and whatnot. But that he doesn't want to look like an idiot among whatever his group of peers that he believes in, that's more important than, say, a bottom line or a commitment to free speech.
I do think that.
Yeah. And do you think
that's based on observation over a period of years?
Right. Yeah. And Facebook as well. And this might explain why. Well, I guess I don't know if are the people who get banned from these services, are they reliably, you know, are they right of center? Are they left of center? Is it a mix? And we just don't hear about other people. But, you know, in terms of the kind of algorithm, do you find platforms like Gab then to be some kind of, vision of the future, where Gab, which was started after a kind of mass purging of certain right-wingers from Twitter, is a social media platform where they say, we're not going to use algorithms. We're not going to censor anybody.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't use Gab. I nominally have an account on Gab, which I got just to kick off somebody there who was pretending to be me. Uh-huh. But I have never gabbed, if that's the term. So it's I just don't spend any time on that. When I quit Twitter, people said, "Oh, you should go to Gab," and I'm like, "Well, Gab may be a freer version of Twitter, but I suspect the other toxic characteristics remain, and I'm really trying to detox. It's not like just saying, well, you know, I've got a real bad hangover from tequila, so from now on, I'm only going to drink scotch." Yeah. I mean, I felt like it was just a bad idea.
So how, just before I ask another question related to technology, how has this affected your kind of traffic levels or your visibility online? Do you have a sense, like, does Instapundit, get less traffic now because you're not on Twitter, or has it stayed the same? How is that working for you?
My blog traffic is actually up. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's because of going off of Twitter or not. With the political environment we've got now, it's really hard to say.
Yeah. And you are still on you're still on Facebook though.
Yeah, I use Facebook though, mostly for friends and stuff. I don't see that as the same kind of outlet that, like, I use Twitter for. What I will say is, you know, I'm sure that I have in some ways less impact on stuff by not being on Twitter. Mm-hmm. But first, I don't care. I don't live to be a thinkfluencer, to use a Jeff Jarvis phrase from about 15 years ago. And second of all, to the extent I'm having an influence on Twitter, you know, it is probably a bad influence, because the thing about Twitter, and I'd like to think I'm immune to it, but I'm not, is that Twitter is the place where people put a lot of half thought out hot takes that probably would be a lot better if they thought about them for at least 20 seconds. And I don't think it's any huge loss for people who, sure, I would get off a nice sharp line every once in a while, and that always makes you feel very pleased with yourself. And, you know, it's not like I was getting paid to do it. So it's not the worst thing. I will add, though, my favorite social media platform before they ruined it and it died was actually Yik Yak. I don't know if you remember that.
I'm familiar. Absolutely. Yeah.
It was great on campuses because it was anonymous and it was uncensored.
Yeah.
And it really meant that when you got a lot of places where you had sort of this PC, you know, woke mob going on, Yik Yak was the place where the normal students, which was 95% of the student body, said, "This is bullshit." And that happened repeatedly on campuses where that went on. And you also just learn things. One of the things I learned about undergraduates from being on Yik Yak is that they talk about pooping as much as 80-year-old men. I mean, who knew? They ruined it by trying to make it more like Facebook. They took away the anonymity and everything, and then it died. And it was really too bad, because I found it really sort of fun and useful.
But you seem then to have a mixed attitude towards anonymity, which is, you know, going back to the older Usenet days, as well as not CompuServe or Prodigy, but AOL, America Online, had massive anonymity on it. That was one of its selling points back in the day. But because you know, at one point in the book, you say, you know, one of the fixes here, and I've heard this discussed in other contexts as well, is if we get rid of anonymity, then people will, will behave better.
Yeah, no.
What is it? That's not my fix.
That's not a fix I recommend. That's a fix I discuss and kind of dismiss because, as I say when I talk about it, Vertovigi's story, True Names, was meant to be a cautionary tale.
Right. So before we, I want to go to like what you think would help fix the social media landscape. You also talk about your Wikipedia page, and obviously Wikipedia is not social media per se, but what were the, you know, it's part of your souring on the internet, right? Like, you know, God damn it, this, you know, this wonderful technology, which early on you talk about how, you know, the kind of information age ushered in by the internet and the web and, you know, this mass democratization of publishing, you know, is as big a deal as we've ever experienced. But what was going on with your Wikipedia page?
I've kind of forgotten the details now. There was a period where when you went to my page on Wikipedia, there was a big photo of me wearing an I Had an Abortion t-shirt. And that photo was actually a Photoshop done by Ala Pundit back when he had his own blog before he was at Hot Air, which tells you how long ago it was. And then there was another time where Nick Denton unveiled Gawker. Yeah. And Anna Marie Cox, who's a friend of mine, Wonkette. Anna Marie Cox was blogging. She's a friend of mine. So I pimped it on my site several times the first day it opened, just as a courtesy. And it happened that at about the same time, I purchased a sports car. And so my Wikipedia interest at one point said that many people who were unnamed thought that the sports car was actually Nick Denton's payoff for the promotion of Wonkette. Mm-hmm. And I did get that removed, although in retrospect, I should have left it there, because if that had been a general view that my promotion was worth a sports car, it probably would have redounded to my benefit.
I would think so. Yeah. You know, you got nothing to complain about there as long as you got receipts, right? So.
I want to push back. I'm not at all complaining about the technology. There's all kinds of technology out there. To say that social media platforms are a bad use of the internet is no more saying that, you know, the internet has gone sour than saying that the Ford Edsel means that automotive technology is bad.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of untrustworthy information out there. Okay. And that's, you know, that's part of the current moment of, you know, both on the, you know, conservative Republicans as well as liberal or progressive Democrats are talking about regulating the internet. There, Kara Swisher of formerly of Recode, writing in the New York Times over this weekend, said, you know, it's time to like get rid of Facebook. Josh Hawley, the senator, Republican senator from Missouri, has said the same thing. Before we go into specific fixes, there is a lot of untrustworthy information out there. Two questions. First, is it worse than in the past? And then secondly, you know, what do you do about that? That when people see a picture of you on your Wikipedia page saying, I had an abortion t-shirt, like, what is the way to get people to process that information more critically?
Well, yeah, I'm not a big believer in trying to eliminate unreliable information because I don't trust anybody to do it. I mean, I come at all of this from a sort of public choice economic standpoint where I assume that people who are in charge of any institution, including the ones that are there to allegedly do fact checking, will tend to deploy their power in ways that serve their own interests rather than their alleged mission. So I don't trust it. I don't trust anybody, any person, any entity, any group to vet information to tell me if it's legit or not. And I've had enough exposure to some of the internet fact-checking operations to be deeply distrustful of them.
And you're also a law professor where you recognize even under the best of circumstances where people are actually acting in good faith, there are going to be times where people absolutely see things differently, right?
Oh, absolutely. And, when you have all the complicated resources and procedures of the criminal justice system, it's very hard to be confident that what you conclude actually happened is what actually happened, and you frequently turn out to be wrong later. So there's just no procedure that actually reliably determines the truth. That said, some things are structured in ways that favor spreading falsehoods, and some things are structured in ways that favor spreading more accurate information. And I do think it's fair to say that things like Facebook and Twitter are fertile ground for misinformation.
Why is that?
Well, it goes back to the fact that people often will share things based solely on a headline. And what that means is if the headline is, how should I say it, provocative, but the story rows it back to the actual facts, people will retweet the headline a million times, and that's all most people will ever read because nobody bothers to follow the link. That encourages the spread bad information.
So is the fix to that, and this is apart from any kind of larger legal changes that we'll get to in a second, but isn't it that we all have to be better readers and better, critics of what we're seeing and the information that we're consuming in the end? And then maybe also, without getting, kind of existentialist about it, that we have to be acting in better faith than we are.
Oh, absolutely. And, one of the things I talk about in the book, I said, one of the reasons cities started to work better was people basically acquired better immunity. And, the two things that James Scott says help people deal with infectious disease are acquired immunity and better nutrition. And so my suggestion is people need better mental nutrition, which essentially just means a better education in critical thinking and actual, history and facts and stuff. And also an ability to identify propaganda. And I, in fact, talk about how when I was in an enrichment program when I was in sixth grade, and we used Layman Allen's propaganda game, where they teach you different types of propaganda approaches, and then they show you news stories that use one or the other and ask you to identify the techniques that are being used. And that's a pretty good critical thinking tool. If everybody had that in school, that would help. It wouldn't fix the problem completely, but it would certainly help. Right now, if anything, I would say people who were educated in the 50s, before I was born, were probably better trained in critical thinking appropriate to this environment than people who grew up in the last couple of decades.
Although I hate to tell you this, because you and I are closer in age than we're apart, but I was looking at a Pew Research study recently that said the older you are, the more gullible you are online.
I have to say, I do see that in my own family. so I can, but on the other hand, it's a bonding experience between some of my older relatives. they share links to Occupy Democrats. And
Do you, you've written a lot about education reform as well. So, I mean, it's a great dream to hope that people will become more critical. It's unlikely, it seems, that it's going to come through the K-12 or the higher education system or the law school system. But do you have any sense that people might be getting better at this? Because this is also all kind of relatively new technology. I mean, social media is, realistically maybe a decade old as a mass phenomenon, if even. And you were talking earlier about how, when the internet started and a variety of platforms, it was this great, shiny, utopian thing where finally we were going to come together like, the Aztecs in a Neil Young song and lift many stones and be peaceful instead of like rapacious, sacrificers of our weaker cousins. And now we're in the thick of the dystopian phase where it's like, God, this stuff is so awful. But typically with technologies, there's a third phase. If it's a worthwhile technology, and we get better at it, or we de-emphasize it. And actually, in your book, you kind of talk about that at one point, that one response to all of this is to take social media less seriously.
Yeah, one of the problems you have, I spend a fair amount of time talking about the outrage mobs that get people fired from their jobs. And, one of the big lessons, I think, is that if you're a company or a university or whatever, and there are a bunch of people on Twitter calling for someone to be fired, the single best thing you can do is just ignore them.
Yeah.
The fact is,
or at least give it like 20 or 30 minutes, right, to see if it's real or not. Yeah.
Well, 2 or 3 days at least, because, honestly, most of the time they'll have moved on 2 or 3 times since then. And I think one of the problems organizationally with that is every big organization now has a in-house social media expert. And that person is the very last person who will tell you not to pay attention to what happens on social media, even though that should, in fact, be their starting point generally, is to say, this will probably blow over. Give it a couple of days, because that's almost always true.
Right. And of course, corporations are, like criminals in the old Batman comics, they're craven and superstitious.
So
they're
going
to immediately do the worst possible thing that they can at the earliest.
Well, and what's funny is then what happens is they usually get a double whammy, because you give in to the mob and you fire somebody, and then you get a whole fresh mob mad at you because you fired them.
Yeah. I like the, there's a story going around now about the school lunch lady who was fired for supposedly for giving a kid a free lunch when he owed money. And so then she got fired, and then she was reinstated. And then it turned out she was lying about why she gave the kid the lunch in the first place. So who knows? I mean, this might be the story of our lives, that's going to consume us, for the rest of all eternity. So, well, let's talk about the actual, you do at one point, you kind of run through various fixes that have been proposed, including ending online anonymity, removing Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, certain that immunizes platforms and publishers from certain kind of legal action, more scrutiny of users, more scrutiny of content, which would be kind of like censorship, algorithmic transparency. And you say, okay, these are all ways that people have talked about trying to regulate or to reform social media. It's not going to work, mostly because they all intersect very negatively with the First Amendment. So even if they were good ideas, they're not going to get very far. And then you reject them for an antitrust-based solution. Talk a little bit about that. And I have to say, as somebody who, again, has been reading you for 20 or 25 years, you know, both as a legal scholar as well as an online content producer, as a Thinkfluencer, whether you want to cop to that or not, a Thinkfluencer who had a card given to him by the head of Gawker while wearing an I Had an Abortion t-shirt, I was surprised.
But that was a good day.
What's the antitrust fix that you prefer? Well,
I will say this does not actually represent much of a departure for me. In fact, I had a big argument when I was not long, I was like the year after I got out of law school, with friends, then boyfriend, who was an econ grad student at MIT, all about Robert Bork and antitrust. And, you know, I said, Bork's got this wrong. The antitrust laws were never primarily about consumer welfare and prices. It's odd that Robert Bork, who's an original intent guy, ignores the fact that the original intent of the framers of the Sherman and Clayton Acts was in part to limit excessive business power in the political world. And that's really always been the case. And so this is not a huge change for me. I don't write about antitrust much, but that's always been my view. And I think that's the case here. We talk about, you know, trust busters like Teddy Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt broke up Standard Oil, but John D. Rockefeller had a lot of political power because Standard Oil had a lot of money because it sold a lot of oil. By contrast, Facebook and Twitter and Google basically stand astride the nation's political nervous system. They actually control communications that are an important part of the political process, and they already distort them to their own benefit, as you might expect. So I think that's a much bigger threat. And I think that...
Well, I was going to say, because and you're citing Tim Wu, the Columbia law professor, the architect of the policy that became known as network neutrality, but has now moved on to his latest book is called The Curse of Bigness. And it's a brand kind of analysis coming out of Louis Brandeis of just saying when companies get too big, regardless, they might still be giving customers more variety at lower prices, but bigness itself is a problem.
I think that's right. Yeah, I disagree with him on network neutrality, but he's a good guy. Yeah, and one of the interesting things, I just spoke this past week at Stanford Law School. I had a conference on free speech and social media, and a couple of things really struck me there. One, and this would really worry me if I were Facebook or Google or whatever, is everybody hates them. Like, you would expect them to have, you know, critics on the left and defenders on the right or vice versa. No, they're people from all across the spectrum. Are unhappy with them, see them as really a very similar kind of threat, and to a non-trivial degree are calling for similar solutions. I mean, the antitrust breakup idea is one that has a lot of support on both the left and the right. And I think that it's because it has a lot of force.
How is Facebook, because Facebook, you know, is this example where last year or over the past 12 months, we did see people like Ted Cruz, as well as Elizabeth Warren. You know, we see people on very much on the conservative right and the progressive left attacking Facebook for throwing the election to the other person. How is Facebook actually deciding elections, or how is it squelching speech, even if it is trying to, you know, kind of toss it one way? Because Hillary Clinton says Facebook cost her the election. It wasn't her campaign. It was Facebook because of Russian bots. Ted Cruz is like, you know, because Diamond and Silk aren't, you know, as big as, I don't know, Laurel and Hardy or something. You know, that can only be because Facebook is squelching conservative speech. So, I mean, what is it, though? Because it seems to me like if we're gonna break up a company, we should be pretty damn sure that we understand exactly how or whether they're actually changing the outcomes of elections, if that's the reason to break them up.
Yeah, I don't actually think they have yet. I think the Hillary thing is kind of BS. What really happened, as best I could tell, is Trump actually took a lot of advice from Facebook and deployed a Facebook-based campaign strategy. And Hillary's people all said they were much too smart and didn't need any help from Facebook because they had their own analytics that were better.
Yeah, he had much, much better engagement and continues to. Fox News, the Daily Mail, Donald Trump consistently are among the very top, the most engaged presences on Facebook.
So the claim that Facebook just threw the election is I think, silly. I'm not saying they couldn't do it in some other election. I mean, they have done experiments, which they've published, in which they can affect users' mood and engagement. And, they did an experiment that was designed to increase voter turnout. But if you can do that, you can suppress it just as well. And it's entirely possible that they might swing a close election.
Man, don't you miss the days when you would play Mafia Wars or something on Facebook? That's like a totally different universe, though. It's like it's an alternate timeline.
I no longer get... What was the farm game that you're always getting damn invitations from? I mean, I don't get those anymore.
It used to be such a nice neighborhood.
But when you talk antitrust law, to break up Facebook as Facebook, that actual site, is relatively difficult. I think you'd have to show that they had done something underhanded to achieve their market share, which, I mean, it could be true, but I don't have any special reason to think it is. However, what they have done, and what all the big tech companies have done, is they have acquired a lot of competitors and brought them under. So when you have Facebook, I actually had a friend do this. I hate Facebook. I'm quitting it. I'm going to Instagram. That'll show up. Right. And I was like, Facebook owns Instagram, and they own WhatsApp and they own a lot of stuff. And, and what's more, there's considerable evidence that these big companies basically, to use a popular modern word, engage in collusion. So that, for example, when Gab was coming up as a competitor to Twitter, or BitChute was coming up as a competitor to YouTube, PayPal basically cut them off, which was convenient. So I think there's a lot of room to police collusion among them and to basically separate them up into separate companies, which will have to sink or swim or compete on their own. And I think that would help substantially.
So let me, and I'm looking at, this is towards the very end of the book, a passage, and then I want to ask you a couple of questions before we sign off here. But you say, policing platforms and collusion among them, however, is likely to do more good than censorship. An approach based on antitrust and competition will preserve free speech while reducing social media abuses. As social media grows more pervasive and more obviously destructive, the pressure for regulation is sure to grow. Better to regulate in a way that preserves free speech and that doesn't empower tech oligarchs. Those are really nice sentiments, but as you were talking earlier, you are, influenced by public choice. How the hell do you pull that off without creating, just the next set of, of horrible kind of alliances between government and companies that we then need to break up again and again and again?
Well, there's one precedent where antitrust did help, and that is the antitrust case against IBM, which was actually, I think, mostly bogus. But it happened that at the time that was going on, IBM developed the PC. And because they designed it essentially with a policeman standing at their shoulder, they wound up designing an extremely open system.
So you buy that argument.
PC, I do buy that. I think that's right. Okay. That led to a very... open PC world with a lot of competition, and I think really caused the personal computer revolution to be a lot bigger than it would have been. And I think, there's a saying in regulation, because I also teach administrative law, the saying is the value of the sword of Damocles is that it hangs, not that it falls. So I think it's useful to put some pressure on the companies, and I think some forced divestitures would be helpful as well. I just think that's much safer than getting the government involved in actually policing content.
Right? Oh, God, I completely agree with – I mean, the idea that, we're going to have some review board that in the end is saying, okay, well, Sargon of Akkad is okay, but Alex Jones is no good. Louis Farrakhan is okay, but, whatever. No, that's insanity, totally. But I just am terrified by, the idea that the government is going to get to start to say, okay, well, you got to get rid of WhatsApp. You got to get rid of Instagram, but you can keep this. You're okay with Oculus for now, but don't get too grabby. I mean, it just seems to me this is all being done in the name of trying to promote innovation. But at the same time, it's kind of telling every company, like, it's like a nightmare of a kind of passive aggressive parent, an icebox, you know, mother saying like, why don't you love me more to get away from it? You know, it's, I just don't see that ending well. And I'd like to think, and I guess, let me ask you this. You don't have a lot of faith then in, you know, that Facebook, even as, you know, in the span of this podcast, Facebook might have just disappeared. It might have, you know, it might have been overtaken by MySpace or Friendster or AOL or, you know, I mean, the internet cyberspace is littered with the rotting hulks of once great civilizations.
It
right?
is, but the rate of turnover has really dropped. And I think that's because the existing big companies have cemented their positions in a way that, say, MySpace or Friendster never did. And I will add one other thing. One of the things at this conference, somebody said is, you're a libertarian. How can you be in favor of antitrust? And I was like, well, there's two answers to that. The technical answer is Facebook and other social media companies, in fact, exist because of regulation. Their business model is only possible because essentially of Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which allows them to build a business around content provided by other people while not being responsible for libel or copyright infringement or whatever else that's in all that content for other people. They couldn't possibly function without
but
that ability.
You've got to be, I mean, there's two ways to talk about that. One is that there's no question because of Section 230, the internet developed in a particular way where user-generated content became a big part of how things develop. But secondly, isn't that a good thing?
I'm not sure.
Really?
You know, as... What
I mean, you got rid of, do you still have comments at InstaPundit?
Yeah,
I can't remember.
Yeah, I have comments. Like, I never got rid of comments. I was a late adopter.
Yeah, no, I mean, we were like, okay, we're going to have comments and we're not going to regulate, or, you know, we're not going to moderate them, which was our prerogative. And of course, under 230, we could moderate them and still not be responsible for the bad ones that got biased or anything. But it seems to me, what a massive expansion in the ability to express yourself and to engage in, you know, and I'm laughing to myself when I say like to engage in ideas because 99% of comments, like 99% of actually edited and curated content is, you know, beneath, you know, garbage. But it just seems like such a, you know, a supplemental space for expression that it's self-evident that that was a good thing.
Well, open comments have their ups and downs. I mean, the advice I generally give people is don't read the comments if you want to be happy. But it's also true that what we're getting out of Facebook, et cetera, is not that. That in fact, it's all, you know, it's there's a lot of algorithmic jiggery pokery, and they are not showing you that it's not a, you know, free for all, free speech zone. They are presenting what they want you to see when they want you to see it. And it's certainly not at all the sort of thing that was anticipated when Section 230 was enacted.
Sure.
That's the technical. The philosophical argument is this. As a libertarian, you know, there are people who say, I basically don't care what's done as long as it's not a government doing it. I actually do. I mean, I actually think that being oppressed by a corporation is normally in a free market environment, not very likely and not very easy. But when you are being oppressed by a corporation, you're still being oppressed. And the fact that it's being done not by a government representative doesn't matter. And also, usually there's a lot of collusion between the government and the corporation. It's not like we're living in a true free market where corporations do whatever they want, government does what it wants, and there's no overlap between the two. That's never been the case, and it's certainly not the case today.
Yeah, no, I agree with that, and I think that that's one of the kind of the issues, and examining how that plays out in specific instances with the dynamic you're talking about is really important for if we're going to have a vibrant libertarian intellectual sphere as well as kind of social movement, we need to be grappling with that on a much more muscular and aggressive way than I think we have been. But you don't have any sense then, or do you think that Twitter, which is losing, by most accounts, is losing average daily engagement among users, the number and the time they spend on Facebook in North America has reported flat and declining numbers among the average daily users and things like that. You don't think that that the market will punish these, these platforms if they don't actually start making, their walled gardens into places that we actually want to hang out?
You know, it may punish them, but it may not punish them enough to change their behavior, to change the effect. I mean, the nightly network news has been punished by the market because it's It's dreadful, and yet.
But
it's
I hear
still
rumors.
Around.
Yeah, I hear rumors. It's still on. Yeah, I mean,
I couldn't say firsthand, but yeah.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? I mean, like when you think about when's the last time that you watched a network news program, and I guess all of the networks, with the exception of Fox, the over-the-air channel, have them, and they probably still get more eyeballs than the most highly watched cable show. And I guess MySpace still probably is pulling. I mean, we know Yahoo is still like one of the top destination sites on the internet. Who would have thought? Well, we're going to leave it there. We are talking to Glenn Reynolds. He is the Instapundit, the blog father, University of Tennessee law professor who writes widely and often at USA Today and elsewhere. His latest book, From Encounter Books, you can buy it at Encounter Books or at Amazon or anywhere else that you buy books, is The Social Media Upheaval. Glenn, thanks for talking so much.
Thanks so much.
And I guess, you know what? Let me, now that I've made the big wind up in the final, like the other thing that you have really staked out is a kind of keto friendly low carb diet. Are you now, like, without starting a whole other podcast, how is that working?
It's working out great for me.
Not so much for the planet, because like the amount of rainforest that goes so that you can have steak every night.
The rainforest can take care of itself. Yeah. What did the rainforest ever sacrifice for me? No, I mean, I think that I don't really do a keto diet. I do a generally low carb diet, but I don't go that far. But I have lost about 30 something pounds, and I feel better. And everybody tells me I look a lot better. And one of the interesting articles I read, I wish I could remember where. You might actually remember. Somebody wrote an article like 10 or 15 years ago that said, why do all libertarians seem to reject the conventional dietary wisdom? And of course, I wanted to find that. I actually looked for it recently, couldn't find it, because the conventional dietary wisdom was all wrong. So it would be really nice to sort of revisit that and say, because we're not stupid.
Or we're stupid in our own individualized ways. Because I eat mostly. Yeah, I eat mostly a vegan diet after having done a kind of Atkins diet for a number of years and enjoyed it. But, well, again, the book is From Encounter Books. It's The Social Media Upheaval. It's by Glenn Reynolds. It is a really provocative book. And I have to say, Glenn, it's great talking to you. And I appreciate your sharing not just your time, but kind of the discussion of your journey over the years, because this is as history takes shape, you are one of the main players in what we call the kind of social media landscape or the blogosphere, et cetera. So it's particularly interesting to hear your thoughts and the way they've changed over the years.
Thanks.
This has been The Reason Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at Google, at Apple, at Spotify, at SoundCloud, at Reason.com, and rate and review us wherever you find us, and let us know how we're doing. Thanks for listening.